You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, powered by Interstate Batteries. From your truck to your trail camera, Interstate Batteries has you covered. Visit your local Interstate Battery store today or online at interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Welcome to the DIY Sportsman Podcast, with your hosts, Garrett Prawl and Boudreaux Boswell. On today's episode, we have Harmon Carson, also known as the Bayou Bow Hunter on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. He's an avid whitetail hunter based in Louisiana, where he chases after hard-to-hunt deer with a traditional bow and has had quite a bit of success. He also self-films his hunts, has more recently started hunting out of a saddle, and takes annual trips out west for elk, bear, and mule deer. So what part of Louisiana, I guess, are you from, and what's the habitat like there? Every time I think of Louisiana, I just think of the big, you know, swamps that you see on, like, Swamp People.
Right. It's so funny. It doesn't matter where I go. If anybody finds out, like, I'm from Louisiana, it's, oh, Swamp People. But, South Louisiana is very much like that. I live in Northwest Louisiana. There's quite a few people that just call us Southern Arkansas where I'm at, but I'm in Northwest Louisiana near outside of Shreveport, and man, it's a pretty good mixture of habitat. It's big hardwoods, a lot of pine plantation, and there are there's quite a bit of swamp bottom, but it's not like widespread like what it is in South Louisiana, but there are very, very large swamp bottoms that kind of hang close to the rivers and bayous and stuff. But it's overall, it's super, super thick. I mean, you have open hardwood bottoms, and then some of the pine plantations are the older, more mature ones are, you know, open. But for the most part, Louisiana is a very, very thick state. Tons of underbrush.
And is it kind of a mix of private and public land, or is it more one than the other?
Oh, it's absolutely more private land than public. Most people around here, they have to have hunting leases to hunt on, you know, and it's little blocks of property, which makes it tough to do a lot of the hunting that, you know, you see people talk about doing on shows or magazines. It's like there is public land, but there's really not a lot of public land, and the public land that's there gets hammered.
Gotcha. Yeah, that would be hard for me because, I mean, at this point, for me, when I try and look for new land, I like to look for, you know, the more acreage, the better. If it's, like, not at least 3,000 acres, it's almost like it's not even big enough, you know? So it's, like,
right.
The small parcel stuff, that would really have to make me change if I was in that type of a location.
Yeah, and, I mean, there are blocks. There's a WMA wildlife management area here close to me that's like 32,000 acres, but it's really long and narrow, goes almost up to Arkansas, and it actually, the bottom of it is about 5 minutes from my house here, and it's huge, but again, it's you can get on it. It's one of the larger ones, especially for this area. But there's still little blocks of private that shoot in and out of it, and the boundaries aren't marked super well, so you better make sure you've got a good map program.
Gotcha. What's the, I guess, the hunting culture like down there?
Oh, it's about all there is. Like the hunting is huge down here. It's called the sportsman's paradise for a reason. Just about anybody you run into is going to be a hunter, and if they're not a hunter, typically it's because them or their family moved in because of Barksdale Air Force Base or, you know, one of the other Air Force situations. But most people hunt down here. It's part of the reason why it can be frustrating, especially for, like, this time of year is turkey hunting. And Louisiana has the lowest huntable turkey population, but the highest turkey hunter population per capita.
Oh, wow.
So it's really frustrating.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But so yeah, there's a ton of hunting, hunting pressure because of all the hunters.
So what's it like hunting from probably one of the lesser thought of states for whitetail deer in the country? I mean, when most people think of whitetail deer hunting, Louisiana is probably the bottom of the list, if not on the bottom
right.
of the list.
Well, I tell you this, and this is not because I live here, and it's not by any means. I've talked to people from all over. I've talked to different outfitters in other states. If you learn to be successful with a bow on a whitetail in Louisiana, you will be successful and can be successful anywhere in the country. I've talked to multiple guys, and they all, you know, they have a wide variety of experience hunting all over the country, and they all say this part of the country, Louisiana especially, is one of the most difficult places to be successful bow hunting because of the hunting pressure and the thickness of the habitat here. So it's unique, man. It's really, really tough. It's really frustrating, but there's opportunities to learn things here that you can apply in other places that you're not necessarily able to learn and apply, in the Midwest or in the North or even out West, just because of the how thick it is. You know, a lot of folks, when they hunt elsewhere, you see a lot of people talking about glassing deer and, you know, sitting back from a distance and watching. And, there's a bunch of scouting tactics that people talk about and you see on TV and you read about, and that you can't do it. Like it's, you're not doing that in Louisiana. Like there's no sitting back and glassing. It's very, very, you know, burning the rubber off your shoes, getting out there in the thick of it, trying to find them. And I realize you have to do that other places as well, but Louisiana is just, it's a tough place. It's as far as the hunting regulations go, you can kill six deer a year. Our bow season goes from October 1st to January 31st. But I think starting the third week of October, the third week of October is, I'm getting this mixed up. The third weekend of October starts muzzleloader season, and then rifle season starts, I think, November, and it goes all the way through the second week of January. So we have nearly 3 months of gun hunting, and because even the third week of January is a muzzleloader week, our primitive weapon week, and then the very last week of January is back to bow hunting only. So you have nearly 3 months of rifle hunting. You have just, you know, a couple of weeks of bow hunting only, and during that time you can kill six deer, three does, two bucks, and then you get one either sex tag. And there's no regulation on the bucks in terms of size limits, unless further south you go, there's a few parishes that have a couple of point restrictions, antler restrictions, but for the majority of the state, you can kill it. Doesn't matter whether it's a spike or a, you know, 160-inch deer, you can kill it. So it's a lot of pressure, and just, like I said, just about everybody and their dog hunts, literally dogs, because dog hunting is huge down here.
that was going to be my next question. I know in southern Arkansas, and even just the general South, dog hunting is pretty big in that area. So that was my next question: were dogs allowed? Beat me to that one.
Yes, sir. Yeah, they're definitely allowed.
So I can almost see how if you had access to a fairly sizable chunk of land and you just stayed out of it the entire year, you could kind of almost maybe get it loaded. But then, of course, you're missing out on all the action for yourself throughout the earlier seasons.
Right, and it's. You would think it would be, I guess to, it's very difficult to find a chunk of property in Louisiana, like a large chunk of property in Louisiana that's all together. Most of Louisiana, even the privately owned places, it's broken up. You know, you'll have 30 acres here, 60 acres here, 150 acres here. 400 here, but it's all, you know, it's like a jigsaw puzzle. It's all fit together. There's very few, until you get into like the agriculture, that is like old plantations, that's passed down through family, and it's like family estate type properties. Most of Louisiana is privately owned, and it's been segmented, so many times that it's little bitty sections of property. In theory, what you said is correct, but it's not very probable to find something like that.
Interesting. So then for your tactics and how that kind of, you know, forces you to do what you need to do, do you run like trail cameras at all too, or kind of what's your throughout the year strategy for being able to, I guess, get on deer and then actually be able to hunt them? What kind of things are you doing, and are you doing anything different than you think a majority of the guys in your region?
I am, yes, trail cameras are a major, major part of how I hunt. I try to keep at least, a dozen trail cameras going, which, that's a lot for me. It's just, you know, one of those things that you acquire as you can get them. And, I've gotten up to 15, and I think I'm actually back down to like 9 just because of flooding, you know, and them going out. But I had quite a few flooded over the past few years with all of our rain that we've been having. But I try to early season, I do what I call a shotgun approach with my trail cameras. On the properties I have permission to hunt, whether it's public land or private, I have private family land that I hunt. I also have land that is leased, and I have some land that I just have permission to hunt on. And again, the public land. So obviously I try to hunt. You obviously don't want to put all your eggs in one basket. So I try to get as many options as I can. And when the deer are starting to grow, I put cameras all over the place and try to locate bachelor groups. And once I locate a bachelor group, I try to figure out which buck is going to turn into what I think is going to be a shooter. And I try to target mature bucks. So I try to figure out what buck's going to be the mature buck. And the closer it gets to season, I kind of pick which deer I'm going to chase. And I always try to have, you know, at least two different ones just in case one stops being consistent or disappears on me, I'll still have another one. And I slowly start clustering my cameras in the areas of this single deer. So that kind of tells you one of the things I do is I try to find a specific buck and target a specific buck rather than just hunt deer in general. And the reason being is when I can figure out one buck, that one buck will tell me what other bucks in the area are going to do, like patterns that they're going to travel. Because if one buck's comfortable doing it, then just about any other buck that comes to that territory, whether he's ever been there or not, is going to be comfortable going through that same area just because they're creatures of habit. So I rely on my trail cameras real heavy for situations like that. And I completely forgot where I was running with all of that. So,
so I mean, it seems like once you get, I guess, trail camera data and you learn all about a specific deer, and let's say you shoot that deer, then, you know, in the following years, when new deer come in and take over that same area or that same territory, you have a lot better understanding of what tendencies there might already be for that deer to follow because you've probably already seen it in the past.
Yeah, so what it is you know, like I said a minute ago, the deer creatures have had it, you know, and there are certain reasons why they like to travel the way they do, whether it's a terrain feature, whether it's a habitat feature, outside pressure that they're aware of that we might not be aware of. And, you know, there might just be, you know, there's some areas that just for whatever reason, there's always a rub line, or there's always, you know, obviously there's areas where there's always a scrape, but there's certain, you know, you have 100 acres, and out of that 100 acres, there's really only like maybe 15 acres of that property that's really being consistently used. And it's a matter of trying to figure out how those deer move through the property. And if you can figure out how one deer likes to move through the property, that'll, one, over time, as you over the years, as you figure out how one buck likes to move, you can go to a completely another property. And if you find a buck on that property and you try to figure out how that buck likes to move on that property, you can kind of start seeing patterns, you know, whether it's pine trees, oak trees, swamp, hilly, flat, lowlands, high, you know, you can kind of, if you have access and years of data, I guess, to put against put against it, you can kind of start seeing patterns, because a lot of times I put, like when you're hunting a specific deer, you may or may not have the opportunity at that deer, but what you're at a specific buck, but what you're doing is you're putting yourself in an area that bucks like to travel. Because if one mature buck is comfortable traveling an area in broad daylight, then, you know, 9 times out of 10, any other buck that travels through that area, even if he's from 10 miles away and just happens to be, you know, chasing a doe or, you know, on the hunt, he is more than likely going to be comfortable traveling through the same areas in broad daylight that a local buck would be, just because, you know, the wind might travel through there just right, the land might just work better for ease of travel. You know, there's a bunch of variables there, but you can kind of start seeing patterns from one property to another, one deer to another, and you can apply, you can kind of try to start applying them to different areas. And when I started really paying attention to that, my success on mature bucks spiked, and it's been really neat to see how deer move through properties. And there's been a few little things that have jumped out that you know I've noticed that bucks like, you know, terrain features that deer like to travel regardless of the property. It's just kind of neat. And then you got to figure out the deer's personality, because every deer is different. You know, some are super super skittish and you only get a picture of them every now and then, and some deer, you know, you can nickname them Hollywood because they want to stay in front of a camera, and you know, they're there all the time. They're really active. So they all kind of have their own personality, like a dog, just about. And if you can ever figure that out, that obviously helps you out as well. I'm really detail oriented on my stuff. I pick trail camera pictures and trail camera videos apart, probably more than what a lot of people do. I study them probably more than what I should.
What kind of data are you gathering? When you look at those pictures, are you looking at, you know, what the wind direction was that day when that picture was taken, trying to figure out, hey, this buck only does this route or is in this area or is on this camera with, you know, say a northwest wind, different weather patterns? Or I guess what all are you kind of collecting when you try and analyze those photos?
Sometimes it kind of depends on the deer and on the situation as to whether or not I'm actually looking at the wind, because really this is fixing to sound funny. I in situations like that, the wind only tells me where I need to hang my tree, and how I need to approach the spot. But in terms of the deer activity, what I'm looking at is most of my cameras I try to keep on video mode. I hardly ever use just the trail camera picture. If the camera I use can be put on video, I keep it on video. And the reason is I noticed when the whole video feature first came out that a lot of times you would have deer, if it was a trail camera picture, you just have a deer walking across in front of the camera, where on video you see the deer coming up from an angle and then he gets there and he turns and goes another way, and you can actually see the direction the deer is coming from. And you know, you can see, okay, well, he walked on this side of that tree, or he came in from the other side of that bush. And that little bit of information can tell you a lot in terms of where that deer actually came from. And so I will backtrack a deer based on the direction I see him coming from or going to. And I'll try to, you know, I'm looking at a specific instance with the trail camera. You know, it's a 30 foot, 50 foot, you know, shot in the woods. And when that animal's there, I get a glimpse of what's happening right then. Well, when you can tell where the deer's coming from or going to, then you got to look at it from the big picture. Okay, where is he coming from? Big picture. Where is he going to? Even in the rut, you know, he might not be hanging out in a quote unquote bedding area that he might would early season. But there might be like a temporary bedding area, or it could be from a food source from a neighboring property or a pipeline that might hold does, have does feeding around it, and he's just going along checking that. if you've put your boots on the ground and you know of scrape lines or rub lines in the area, then you can say, okay, well, he's probably, you know, coming from that those scrapes over there, heading to this scrape. Depending on the terrain feature, you can see whether he's following draws or coming up ridge lines. There's a lot of little details in that regard in terms of terrain features and habitat features that help me and that I pay attention to based on where the deer is coming from in the video that I have. Because a lot of times the deer will come in and they'll make a hook. You know, you think you might always be getting pictures of the deer coming in from the left on your camera, when in actuality he's actually coming in from the right and just making a big loop. Because most of my deer in the rut, most of my cameras are on scrapes, and or you know a trail or a rub line, and a lot of times the deer will hook in from the direction of where they're, you know, they're coming in from the downwind side of that. But they might not be traveling on the downwind side of it. They might be coming at a crosswind and then hooking into it. And a lot of times those videos will tell you that information.
So when you piece together kind of the big picture, is there any specific, I mean, are you trying to find, when, like, in terms of your setup and how you're going to act on that information, are you really trying to find where the deer is coming from, or are you trying to focus more on where the deer is heading to? Maybe it's like a, you know, major food source or something like that, or are you just using that information to find certain pinch points along that deer's travel route that you think you can intercept them at?
Yes. all of the above. But most of the time, I'm trying to figure out where the deer's coming from. And the reason being is most of the time I'm going to be hunting where I like to find bedding thickets. I like to find the thickets, even if it's not a, like, really what a lot of people would call a bedding thicket, you know, even if it's just a little bit of a brush that the buck might just stop and take a break in. If there's a rub line going through it, there's a reason there's a rub line going through it. And if I could figure out a thicket like that in the direction the deer is coming from, and I say that, I hunt in a thicket. A lot of times the deer I hunt with my ears almost more than I hunt with my eyes because it's so thick. A lot of times I can only see 20 yards, and when the deer shows up, I'm only looking at his legs from his knees down, and I don't know whether it's a shooter, whether it's a buck or doe or whatever, until it finally gets into a clearing in bow range by that, and I just have to be ready and know whether or not I'm going to shoot it, and because it's so thick. So it's funny to say, yeah, I'm looking for a thicket when I'm actually hunting in the thicket a lot of times, but I try to figure out where it's early season. I guess that's the easiest way to approach it. Is early season, I'm trying to figure out the bedding thicket, because early season they have they're more consistent. They have a pattern. You know, they're still in their summer pattern, and there are areas that they like to bed in. And so early October, they're still kind of in their summer pattern, and I try to figure out where they're bedding most often and where they're coming from, and I backtrack it. Normally I put late summer, my cameras are on a natural food source, whether it's you know, vetch, ragweed, marsh elder, French mulberry, whatever type of natural browsing is going on right then. And the deer tend to come out, you know, in the afternoons, just like what you would if you're glassing. But I use my camera to glass for me. And I check the camera. I'm like, okay, well, these bucks typically are coming from this direction. Well, then I'll leave that camera there, and I'll stagger another camera, you know, 80 yards away, sometimes right beside that camera on the same tree, pointing a different direction, just to try to figure out exactly where those bucks are coming from. And I'll stagger cameras like that until I can get relatively close to what I consider a thicket that a deer would be coming from. Something that I can find a spot that's downwind of the you know, using the prevailing wind that time of year, something that I can slip into, knowing that I'm going to be getting off work, you know, something I can slip into relatively quietly, last minute, And so early season, I'm trying to find a bedding thicket, and I'm crowding it. I crowd bedding thicket. I'm fairly aggressive with my hunting, so I'll crowd a thicket and sometimes get right up in the middle of it on day one. You know, a lot of folks, they start and they don't, they try not to get too close to the thicket, and I'm like, where's he at? I want to be in his bedroom. And so I'll get right in there with them right off the bat. So that's typically what I do early season. As a rut picks up, I start focusing more on scrapes. I hunt real heavy over scrapes, and what I really like hunting is rub lines that connect scrapes. And if I can, what I like to do when the rut really kicks in is I find I'm more on the travel patterns here in the rut versus I guess I'm on a travel pattern in a thicket. Try to find a thicket of the area in the area. But what I'll do is I'll find a rub line, and I will follow the rub line until that rub line goes into a thicket. Once that rub line goes into a thicket, then that tells me that that's more than likely an area that the buck's going to move in daylight. One, that there's more rubs in there, and it's thicker, obviously, so they feel more cover. And even better is once you go into a thicket, at that point, then I start looking at terrain features. And if I can find, a draw or a little dip or something within, or a ridge line within that thicket, that's a terrain feature that I focus on, especially if the rubs, you know, go right along beside that. For whatever reason, I've noticed if I can find like a thicket that also holds a defined terrain feature, like a draw or a saddle or something, that tends to be an area that bucks, at least down here, that bucks like to travel in daylight. And I've killed quite a few, and had really close encounters with quite a few bucks doing that, finding features like that. And then late season, I go back to, they get more, they start reverting back to the summer pattern, starting to try to find food sources again, and they hold even tighter to a thicket. So late season, I kind of go back to my early season tactics of bedding and food scenarios. I don't know if that answered your question or not.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, as you kind of go over that whole scenario, especially from early to late season, and I think about even up here in Minnesota, it's like the things that you're saying are very similar to like the things that I see here as well. It's like, yeah, the terrain might be different. You guys might have different, you know, habitat down there. But in terms of how the deer are acting at different times of the season, you know, like the biggest thing up here is that by the time late season rolls around, the habitat looks completely different. And the bedding's a lot more condensed, and they might be in different areas in late season than they were in early season. But in terms of what the deer are actually doing, yeah, it's definitely the same type of hunting and scouting style.
Yeah, for sure. Do you think your style has kind of really is different because in that area of this U.S., there's not as many defined funnels like between ag fields, you know, a narrow strip of timber, things like that, whereas in the South, it's mostly those thickets that are the funnels where you may have, you know, kind of more open pine stand on one side, and then you find these lower areas that are full of Smilax, Greenbrier, you know, that makes it thicker. You know, do you think that's one of the big things that really made you focus on looking at the details so much?
Absolutely. Yeah, you're forced to, because there's no, it's funny. I've got guys, you know, friends and customers, that come in, they'll go hunt Kansas or Missouri, and they come back, you know, almost every year they're coming back with a quality deer, and they laugh. They're like, man, it's a joke hunting up there compared to, like, you bust your tail down here hunting, and, you know, you go up there, and they said the deer actually act like they're supposed to. They respond to calls. They move around in daylight. You know, if there's a funnel, you go find a spot and hang a tree, and you're going to have deer show up. And it's hilarious listening to my customers and people talk that are successful bow hunters down here, and then when they go up there, man, they clean house every year. It's really funny. And but yeah, I think because it is so thick down here, and if you're going to be a successful bow hunter, you're forced to look at the details. Like you have to. It's something I try to tell people, especially if they're getting into it. Details make the masterpiece. It doesn't matter what you're doing, whether you're actually drawing or whether you're, you know, any aspect of your life, the details make the masterpiece. And it's especially true with hunting, even more so with bow hunting, and even more so with traditional bow hunting. You know, the more details you can pay attention to, the closer it'll put you to a mature deer or a deer period, depending on what you're looking for. But yeah, man, it makes a big difference, and that's part of the reason why you talk to anybody who's successful in the South bow hunting, and you're gonna find somebody who pays attention and really. I hate to sound this, because everybody you talk to, there where they hunt is the hardest place in the country to hunt. Like, it doesn't matter who you talk to. that's just how it is. Everybody thinks where they are is the hardest, and I get that, you know. But the people that you tend to, this is a blanket statement. It doesn't matter what part of the country. The successful bow hunters are the woodsmen. You know, the people who they learn to read the sign that the animals tell you. Or that the animals leave, and it doesn't matter whether you're, you know, in Pennsylvania or in Wisconsin or, you know, in Louisiana. If you can learn to read the sign and apply it to your hunting, then you're going to be successful. And down here, you're forced to read the sign. You can't just sit back from a distance and say, yeah, this is a good, you know, it's a crop with a good funnel. You know, there's a few places in Louisiana like that, but overall there's not many. Like you have to figure out where the funnels are, even though that there's, like, if you were just walking through the woods, there's certain areas that I hunt that people have come in to help me get deer, and they're like, man, what made you pick that tree? Like, this looks like a wide open hardwood bottom. And I'm like, well, it is a wide open hardwood bottom, but there's a funnel here. and a lot of times it'll just be one line of a specific type of tree that goes into the middle of a, you know, where the bottom might be a completely different type of tree. But for whatever reason there, I'm just going to throw some types of trees out there. Say there's a line of cypress trees that goes into a oak bottom. Well, for whatever reason, sometimes those bucks might want to travel the line of cypress trees. I don't know why, but sometimes they'll, and everything will be identical other than that line of trees. And for whatever reason, the bucks will choose that line of trees to walk down, rather than cutting across the oak bottom. And if you can figure that out, then obviously you're going to be a lot more successful, than just randomly picking an oak tree. And that's just an example, but you know, if you can read the details and figure it out, man, it definitely applies all over.
Digital scouting is something that's just become so big, and what a lot of people from the Midwest may not understand is when you go to do digital scouting in the South, in those areas, the topo map pretty much looks the same because there's not a lot of contour changes, and then it's a tree canopy cover, so you can't identify any type of funnel, you can't identify a ridge. I can remember when I started college, I went to college in Central Arkansas, and I remember I had it with this guy, and he's like, go back, walk back down through this bottom, and you'll see a little ridge, and then, you know, follow that ridge out to your left and hone the end of that ridge. I walked around that place for like 2.5 hours until well after daylight, and I'm like, I do not know where this ridge is. And so finally I just hunted off the ground, and I remember, you know, I was like, I'd never found this. He's like, how did you not find this ridge? So he walked back in there with me that afternoon, and when he said ridge, it was like a 1 foot elevation gain.
Yep.
And I was like, how am I supposed to see this? It's dark.
And that is 100% accurate. Like, it's funny, man. It'll be, and that's something I've noticed, that literally can be considered a ridge in some areas, where it'll be a flat bottom and you have one tiny little rise, and for whatever reason that's the spot that the deer want to travel, but everything else is identical except like a foot difference in terrain.
And most people who don't hunt it often would never know it's a rise unless they're there in years where it floods, and then right. The deer really funnel in that, and I guess they get that in their mind. Like you said, they're a creature of habit. They walk it when it floods, so even when there's not a flood, they still walk that same area, and it's, you know, 13 inches of difference over a 20 yard area. And it's like, yeah, I wouldn't have picked that.
That's hilarious. I'm so glad you shared that. Yeah, that is definitely one of those little things that it's frustrating. Like it really can be frustrating because you'll walk right over the top of something like that and for a couple of years, and then all of a sudden realize, wait a minute, there's always deer tracks right here, and you start like, and then you stop and you get to looking and you're like, wait, this is a ridge, this is a high point. And but yeah, it can be frustrating. It's just you gotta definitely slow down and try to figure it out.
I did have one more question on the trail cameras and your kind of strategy for them. Is just how often do you check all your cameras?
Man, I'm completely opposite of what most people are. If I could check my cameras every single day, I would. And in some places, I do. And I know that sounds crazy, but there are some cameras that I will literally check every single day. It doesn't matter the time of year or anything. Now, I'm very low key. Anytime I go in the woods, I'm very low key. Like you won't hardly, I don't hardly talk loud. You're not gonna hardly catch me talking loud in the woods. Period. It's just kind of a personal rule, I guess. Like I don't talk loud. I don't make a lot of noise. Even when I'm walking, I try to be relatively quiet. I slip around more than I do anything, unless I'm just, you know, on a mission to get somewhere or something. But I'm very low key about entering the woods, especially when I get into areas with trail cameras. But part of the reason why I want to check them is deer change their patterns. They go through multiple transitions throughout the year. There's like two or three transitions they go through in the summer, and then during deer season they go through, you know, at least three. And every area is a little different. And it's just if I can't figure out, if I don't know when that deer transitioned, then I don't know that I need to be looking somewhere else, or that I don't know that I need to be looking for a different food source, or, you know, I need to be looking for a different bedding thicket. So I don't really, I'm not too concerned about my scent or anything like that, because I actually, this is again fixing to be opposite of what you might hear a lot of people, but I actually want my scent in there a little bit. Because if the deer is used to picking up little bits and pieces, and again, I'm very low key. I'm not touching. I don't touch the trees. I try my best not to touch anything except my trail camera. But other than just whatever type of lingering scent that follows me in, if a deer walks through and catches that every now and then, I'm okay with that, because it's not strong enough for it to really spook the deer. Because I'm not doing anything over the top. It might make them a little uncomfortable, but it's not going to make them just completely leave the area. And the reason being is if I'm hunting come October and the deer walks through and the wind is slightly off or swirls a little bit, he catches just a little hint, he's not going to turn inside out or immediately get uncomfortable like he would have if my scent had been being in there. And obviously I'm not trying to go in there and leave a bunch of scent. I'm just not really concerned about my ground scent when I go in and out. And in fact, there's been several times that when I've slipped in to go find my camera, I wind up walking up on my target buck. That's happened numerous times. And I just have, sometimes I'll spook him and he'll slip off. And as long as I just grab my card and leave, you know, swap cards and leave, you know, if I spook the deer, then I'm going to give it a few days. I'm going to try my best not to. Again, if I could be there every day, I would. But if I spook the deer, normally I'm going to give it a little bit, a day or two before I go back in. Normally, if I can find the deer or see the deer before he sees me, I will sit tight, let him continue on doing his thing, and then I'll do my thing and leave. So it doesn't stress me out if I bump into the deer or see it, you know, when I'm going in there trying to check my cameras. And there was something else I was fixing to say in that regard, and I forget what it was now. But anyway, no, I don't stress too bad about my how often I go in there. I go in there pretty stinking often.
Yeah, I have a buddy who took that same type of mentality, and he was checking cameras like two or three times a week in a certain area, and kind of doing the exact, he had probably, you know, half a dozen cameras he was checking on that frequency, and he would always do the same exact route and check the cameras in the same order, and just kind of almost
exactly what I was going
to
say.
Almost make himself a pattern that the deer can get used to. So like you said, once if the deer smell you being there, it's like they almost get used to that pattern. And you know, it's like if you look at, you know, farms like around here, like the deer don't get spooked by, you know, tractors or farm equipment or usually like the farmers, because they're used to that kind of stuff going on every day.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. Because that's what I was going to say. When I go into an area, I try to take the same path every single time. You know, even if I'm driving a four-wheeler relatively close on the private land that I hunt, if I'm driving a four-wheeler, I'll leave the four-wheeler running. That way the deer is distracted by the noise of the four-wheeler running, and I'll hop off and I'll walk, you know, 80 to 100 yards or however to get in there to the camera. If it's close, if it's far, obviously I turn the four-wheeler off. But, you know, but I walk the same trail every time, because I noticed that when I get off that trail a little bit, or if I make a loop and try to do something different, that's when I wind up jumping deer. That they just hunker down when I walk by them. But if I try to put myself on a pattern that the deer can pattern, and then when you actually go in there to hunt, you can get just slightly off of your other pattern and wind up killing deer that way. But yeah, what your buddy does is exactly right. You can do that pretty frequently.
That's the same philosophy my dad's had pretty much all my life. Was he would go out and walk through the property two or three times a day, you know, the morning, the afternoon, the evening, and walk through there. And the deer got so accustomed to seeing him and hearing him that they didn't think anything of it. Like you said, you could walk right by a deer, but if you slowed your pace or changed your pace, then they got a little bit more alerted. So if he got in there and got on stand and they come through and smelled him, they didn't think anything wiser of it, because it's an everyday occurrence for them. You're making that part of your natural environment for them.
Right. Right. Yeah, no, that's definitely true. And that's another thing. Like when I go in and I see a deer, I will try my best to ignore. I slow down. Like if I know the deer sees me, and the deer, you know, a lot of times they'll just lock up and stare at you like I'm hidden. And they won't move. They won't run. Or they'll just kind of slowly start easing off. Sometimes I don't stop. I will keep moving. I'll keep doing exactly what I'm doing. I'll act like I don't see them. But I'll just keep a steady pace. I don't do anything erratic. I don't stop and face them. I don't look at them directly. And I just kind of keep them in the peripheral. And a lot of times, I've done this with bucks. In fact, I did this one time and actually killed the deer, because the deer just stood there in the ragweed. He thought he was hidden. Like I was walking down a trail, and I just happened to look over, and there was a deer standing off in the brush, off of the brush, off of the trail that I was walking on. And I'm like, check that out. That's a deer that I would shoot that deer if he stayed there. And the closer I got, and I didn't slow my pace, I didn't do anything, and the deer was on my right. And while I was walking, I pulled an arrow out, knocked it, and last minute, you know, I just turned and I walked backwards the last like 10 yards or so I could have the deer actually on my left side, since I'm right-handed. And as soon as a little gap opened up in the brush, I paused just long enough to hit my anchor point and shot him. So I mean, you could definitely get away with stuff like that. You know, as long as you just keep doing what you're doing and you don't stop and let the deer know, hey, I'm looking at you. You know, they relax pretty, or they can stay relaxed around you. Just because they see you, it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to turn inside out and run away.
Yeah, there's been a couple instances where I've been climbing the tree and kind of pulling my gear up and notice out of the corner of my eye that a deer is already, you know, sort of within bow range, locked up, looking at me, like maybe standing in the cattails or something. And right. it's like if I just like stop and like look at the deer, like it's game over. But if I just kind of keep pulling the stuff up, pull the pack up, pull the bow up, and just like act like I'm, you know, still doing what I'm doing, it's like sometimes I'll just sit there and watch it long enough to get an arrow knocked and draw back.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. It goes back to kind of the personality of the deer. Some of them will, they're a lot more tolerant of things, and other deer, man, they even think you're looking at them and they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
Especially those southern deer, they are a lot more skittish than midwestern deer.
Oh, it's stupid. It is like our deer is schizophrenic. Like there's, it's so ridiculous.
not only do you hunt in probably one of the least desirable states to hunt whitetail deer in, you hunt the most skittiest deer in the world, and right. then you hunt them with a traditional bow on top of that. You're just trying to make it hard on yourself.
Right, that's pretty accurate. Yeah, it's funny because there's not a ton of people down here that hunt with trad bows, and when I first started hunting with one, I got laughed at. It was like, what are you doing? Like, people struggle to kill deer with a gun down here. Why are you doing that? It's just, I don't know, man. I'm very goal oriented. That's one of those things. Once I had my, especially when it comes to hunting, once I had it set in my mind that I wanted to kill a deer with a trap bow, it's like I wasn't gonna stop until I did it. And then once I did it, I was like, this is the best thing ever. I'm never doing anything else. I've never hunted anything else.
How long have you been hunting pretty much strictly with traditional?
I think 2011 is when I started hunting with the trad bow. That was the first year I hunted with a recurve.
And I've seen some of your pictures. It's not just whitetails in Louisiana. You've taken that thing all over the place, it looks like.
Yeah, so I'm kind of in a unique deal where I've been going to Colorado every year since I was probably 2 years old. My dad's been, he goes out there hunting mule deer and elk every year, and he has been ever since him and my mom first got married, and it's just been one of those deals. Anyway, long story short, I've been going out to Colorado every year hunting. That was actually the first place I ever bow hunted in my life was Colorado. I was 12 years old, and I hunted. I was old enough to hunt with a bow, strong enough to draw a bow that could kill a deer, and I hunted Colorado because their season opened before ours, so by default. As I grew up, I just steadily made that yearly trek out there. And actually, my very first—I live in Louisiana, but my first trad kill, traditional bow kill, was a mule deer in Colorado.
Awesome. Is that a spot and stalk type of hunt, or was that more of an ambush?
No, it's funny. We hunt mule deer and elk the same way we do whitetail down here. You know, it's a matter of finding pinch points, finding those funnels of travel routes. Food, bedding, you know, all animals, essentially they're creatures of habit. And if you can figure out what they do in one area, you can apply it to other areas and other species. And, so, you know, mule deer and elk, they like the path of least resistance. So, you hunt saddle, like if you have a ridge of the mountain and then there's a saddle, the deer are going to want to travel over the saddle rather than over the peak of the mountain. And because it's easier, and you go to the saddle and you start finding multiple trails, and then you find cross trails and you get downwind of that, hang a tree, and and hunt. And so I've killed mule deer up there, spot and stalk, but the majority of the animals I've killed in Colorado have all been out of a tree stand. Even the elk, I've killed 3 elk, and all of them have been out of a tree stand.
That's a lot of work pulling a tree stand up those mountains.
Yeah, it's a pain. It's not fun.
Although you hunt with a saddle now, don't you?
Yeah, that's actually, I was just fixing to say, last year we went to a different part of Colorado. We were bear hunting in Colorado, and man, it was awesome. Last year was the first time I hunted out west with a saddle, and my dad and the other guy that was out there with us, they were packing their, they had multiple tree stands, they had all their climbing sticks, like multiple, for multiple setups, and dude, it was so nice just to have my saddle, throw it in my backpack, and I had my one set of climbing sticks that I just put, set up, take down every time, and man, it was so nice. I was done packing way before them.
That's
not
awesome.
To mention, I don't have to haul that thing. I can either wear it in or throw it in my backpack and go. And I'm not having to carry the whole stand in. It's gonna definitely be. It was absolutely a game changer down here, but it absolutely is gonna make my hunts more enjoyable up there.
Oh, I can
it's
imagine.
It's amazing the number of tree stands I've found out here that are 15, 20 yards off the side of a trail because somebody's like, yeah, I'm going to pack a stand back to this wallow. They get about halfway, they're like, nope, I'm done with this, and they just...
Right.
It's like, you didn't even want to carry it back down the mountain.
Right.
You know, 2.5-3 miles in, and boom, there's a tree stand 15 yards off the trail, laid up underneath the tree. They're like, I'm done. I'm not carrying this any farther.
Yep, it was only $40. I'll leave it there.
I mean, I remember.
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
I remember being in Colorado one of the first years we were there, and finding this, you know, secluded wall that you had no idea was there, type of deal, where it didn't show up on the map because it was all dark timber, and you just like happened upon it, right? You just followed a trail, and all of a sudden you just come up upon this wall, and it's like, man, this thing's just loaded with sign, but it's like, how do you even hunt this with the wind swirling as bad as it can in some of those types of spots? It's like, we could just get up in the tree, and like a tree stand would be a nightmare, but a saddle makes so much sense for that type of setup.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's like especially down here, you know, it's primarily hunting out of a tree stand, and there were numerous times this year, I don't know what the deal was, the wind swirled ridiculously down here. I don't know if that's how it was all over the country, but in Northwest Louisiana, the wind was, it was, you know, moody, bipolar. It couldn't make up its mind where it wanted to blow. And there were several hunts. One hunt in particular, I climbed 5 different trees before I finally settled on a tree. Like, I was in the same area. I probably didn't move out of a 30-yard circle, but I climbed 5 different trees because I'd climb and I was like, hey, this will work, and then the wind would shift, and I'm like, dang it. And I'd climb back down, and I'd go somewhere else, and I'd climb up, you know, and finally I settled on a spot that it was the lesser of all 4 other evils, but yeah, that for that situation, man, those saddles, absolutely, they shine.
So how is shooting a trad bow from a saddle? I know that's one question I get a lot, is, you know, how hard is it? Is it difficult? I mean, what's your thoughts on it, just honestly?
Honestly, it's, to me, I don't know why, but I pick, it wasn't difficult for me at all. I've learned some hard lessons. I learned a couple of hard lessons that first year. But overall, I'll be honest, this is fixing to sound completely opposite of what you read on Saddle Hunter or any of the other forums for people that hunt with a saddle. Man, I ordered the Kestrel when I first saw, I don't know if this first year it was made or what, but I ordered the Kestrel, and I didn't get it until it was middle of opening week of season down here is when I received it. As soon as I got it, I was like, awesome, you know, I was pumped. I have trees in my yard. I actually have my bow pretty much stays in the back seat of my truck that time of year. And so when I pulled in my driveway, I pulled the saddle out, I kind of looked everything over, and this is literally the first time I'd ever been in a saddle. I've never hunted out of one, never tried one out, nothing. And I went and grabbed a couple of those muddy climbing sticks, climbed up a tree, had the saddle on, and I figured out how to tie it, you know, tether off, you know, did all that, climbed back down the tree, grabbed my bow, climbed back up the tree, and I shot 2 or 3 times from my front yard within probably 20 minutes of me getting it out of the package. And the next time I was with the saddle, I was hunting. And that's all the practice I did. And, a few weeks later, I killed a hog. Then a couple of weeks after that, I killed a really nice, 150-inch buck out of it. And I was like, man, this is a piece of cake. And there's nothing to this. And but it was because of how I set myself up in those situations. Later in the year, I learned a hard lesson to where you can get so focused on, you know, shooting, and you get really comfortable with it, to where you quit focusing on your form as much, and your form is still obviously very critical. It doesn't matter what you're hunting out of. And there was a particular instance that year where I drew, this was last year, I had a doe come in, and I drew, picked my spot, and shot, and it was almost like the arrow hit her and bounced off of her. And it looked like a perfect shot. And I was like, what in the world? Like, I got no penetration. And the deer runs out there, you know, kind of kicks her leg, looks around, and flicks her tail, and just kind of trots off. And I'm like, that didn't make any sense at all. Well, I kind of went back through everything, and I was in a really bad contorted position. because I had it was late season, and I think I had 8 or 9 does show up. They all walked underneath me at once, and I was in a really bad position, and I couldn't stretch out the way I normally do, and so I just drew and hit my anchor point. And the problem is, I was at such a bad in a bad position that when I drew, I did not fully expand my back tension, and I only drew my bow probably like 6 inches, and so it was like shooting a kid's bow at that deer. And you know, I got like it was just bad. So that was a hard lesson learned. And so from now on, like anybody that I get asked that question as well. And for me, it was not a hard transition, but something I tell people is make sure you focus on your form. Like, you've still got to fully expand. You still have to pay attention to your upper body. You know, you can't. Yeah, you can shoot from a weird position, but even in a weird position, you have to. You know, make sure you're coming to full draw. But honestly, it wasn't. It wasn't bad. The only thing that has been a little bit of a hiccup, and it was honestly the reason why it took me the longest time. I would have got a saddle years ago. I've been looking at them for a long time. Had I hunted with a compound, I would have had one a long, long time ago, and you know, I would have just jumped into it a long time ago. But the reason why I didn't is I'm hunting with a trad boat, and my biggest concern was maneuvering a 60-plus-inch boat around that tether, you know, and being able to shoot in oddball positions, because you can't just, yeah, in theory, you know, you can walk around the tree or you can spin around, but you can't get away with that much movement, because you're one with the trad bow, you're not wanting to get really high, you don't need to get really high, and two, like I said, I don't know about other parts of the country, but down here, you can't get away with very much movement. In fact, I think it was Garrett, it might have been you, I watched one of your YouTube videos a while back. It was actually when I was tossing around the idea of getting a saddle. I was trying to find people who were hunting out of them with a trad bow because it was a concern. And I was like, man, I don't see anybody being successful with a trad bow, and definitely nobody filming themselves being successful with a trad bow out of a saddle. And it was like a spike or full point or something walked underneath you, and you like swung out from behind the tree and went to shoot, and the deer's like looking at you moving, and and you went to, finally the deer like tore out, and I was like, what in the world? Like, why is that deer putting up with that? No, like our there's no way I could have gotten away with that much movement, and so it was a concern. But it's just a matter of, you know, even with the tree stand, you still have to, if you're right-handed, you still want to set your stand up to where the bulk of your shots are going to be on your left side. And so you still treat the saddle the same way, where you set it up to where the bulk of your shots are in your wheelhouse. You know, you try to set it up where you're having to move as little as possible. You know, obviously if you can keep the tree, use the tree as cover, that would be ideal. But, you know, if you can't, the main thing is, you know, setting up where you don't have to move a whole lot. So when I started doing that, and you know, you don't have to move around the tether very much, but I've learned how to use the saddle, and I lower my tether, and it just I've figured out how to maneuver around it now. But that was my concern initially, and that was, I guess, the longest learning curve was figuring that part of it out. But it really wasn't it wasn't a bad transition, man. Not at all.
I think for a traditional bow, to me, they're a little easier because the bow, you don't have, like, if you have a wraparound tree stand or just a tree stand in general, you know, like a climber specifically, there's just more problems for your lower limb than with the saddle.
Absolutely, yeah.
And to me, that's just a big thing, is you get that bow out away from the tree farther where there's nothing there. I mean, your platform or your ring of steps is against the base of the tree, sticks out a foot, foot and a half maybe, but you don't have this big platform, you don't have a shooting rail. And I can remember trying to shoot deer from a tree stand with a traditional bow, and I tried to draw a deer 10 times and never could get to draw without hitting something.
Right.
And it's like, man.
Yeah, it makes it really does. It opens up, and that's what I've told, I've had multiple people call me asking me about hunting out of a saddle, and that's one of their concerns, and I'll tell them, like, it really does. Obviously, there's never a fix-all. Like, there's no fix-all broadhead that's going to kill every deer that you shoot. There's no fix-all arrow. There's no fix-all stand. But my opinion, the saddle opens up more opportunities than any other. Like, there are some situations where a tree stand is just going to be better, whether it's for comfort or hiding, you know, capabilities or whatever. Just, I mean, that's just the facts. Just like there's some areas where obviously hunting off the ground is better. But overall, to me, a tree saddle definitely opens up more opportunities in a lot of ways, from the number of trees or the type of tree that you can get in to, you know, the shot opportunity situation, like what you're talking about. It definitely opens up more opportunities for you. And using a platform with the something to actually plant your feet on, that makes a huge difference as well. The first year, I was just standing on top of my last set of climbing sticks, and that's how I hunted, was standing on my climbing sticks. And that was the only platform I had, was the top two pegs. And it was doable. I killed, you know, quite a few hogs and deer doing that way. But one, it was not comfortable, and I missed an opportunity at a really nice buck at the end of season. A couple of days before I botched the situation with that doe and like short drawing. So that was one of those situations. I was like, you know, if I'd have had a platform, I could have planted my feet, shifted my weight, and been able to get that shot off. That was the last time I did that. I'm a pretty quick learner when it comes to hunting mistakes. If I made a mistake or it didn't work out, then the next time I go hunting, I'm not going to be in that same situation. As soon as that buck got by me, I immediately went and got a platform and fixed. Actually, in that particular tree, I actually hung a muddy lock on, and then was hunting out of my tree saddle, standing on a muddy lock on. That way, you know, I could swing around the tree, and it just opened me up a whole lot more.
One thing that has seemed to make it easier for me is actually making a conscious effort to try and touch my knees to the tree. You know, regardless if I'm using like step style platform or just like a big block style platform, is just to be able to get the attachment not only from your feet on the platform, but also if your knee touches the trunk, and then it seems to be able to free up your upper body a little bit more because you have a little bit more stable base. And then you can have more freedom of movement to get that whole upper body to move more as a unit. Whereas it seemed like if I was just kind of leaning away from the tree, then I was more likely to kind of keep a little bit of bow torque in my, you know, for my upper body.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. I honestly think that's what I was literally just hanging there in a really, really bad position when I tried to shoot that doe. And I wasn't anchored, like you said, on the bottom side. I definitely agree. I try to, I'm either with a knee against the tree or, my knees are essentially locked where I'm leaning out, and I'm not in like a weird, like loose position. I don't know how to describe that other than the loose position. I'm trying to be as stable as I can on the bottom side. So it can, like you said, put your top, your upper body in the position that it needs to be.
Yeah, and you film your hunts too. And I was watching actually one of your recent videos, and you actually run the camera arm a little bit differently than I do in terms of positioning. I thought that was interesting. I might try that out too, because it always seems like it's a pain when you have a saddle. You can't put the camera arm in a normal position like you think you'd be able to with a tree stand, because then you lose the ability to kind of maneuver around the tree quite as much, because that camera arm at a certain point gets in the way. So I thought it was kind of interesting the way you had it set up. It would have been kind of almost the opposite way. Like, we both like to, I think, put the camera arm on the backside of the tree, but I would kind of wrap it around the opposite way that you usually did.
Yeah, the reason, and I might have explained that in the video, but I try to put it on the side that I would actually be shooting on the backside of where I'd be shooting on. That way I can actually control it. Even if I'm pivoting out that way, I'm not having to reach. I'm not reaching around the tree, and I don't have the tree trunk in the way. And when I go to move my, there's less movement between the camera and my bowstring. If I'm having to make an adjustment last minute, you know, the camera arm, the camera itself is right there beside where I'm fixing to shoot, and I can keep tabs on what I'm filming. I can keep tabs on, you know, string clearance, and it's just easier for me to have access to my controls and actually see what's going on when I have it all on the same side of the tree like that.
Yeah, definitely. something to play around with a little bit more. I've got a system right now where I can pretty much, I feel like, in a close quarters hunt, film just about everything and actually make it look pretty decent without a camera arm. But I still may run one anyway, just to get that additional footage.
Yeah, this year I hunted with a GoPro for the first time. I've been hunting with a Sony action camera.
Mm-hmm.
I got a GoPro this year just to try out, and I actually use the hat clip. It clips on the back of the hat or on the side of a hat.
Yep.
And so I wear my hat backwards when I'm hunting with a trad bow anyway, so I clip it kind of over my left eyebrow that way. So I actually made the mistake of shooting at a coyote one time, and the camera was dead center on my forehead, and yet totally it ripped the camera off my face. it broke the camera mount that actually clips to the deal, scared the mess out of me. It was just this. I was like, my bow, it felt like my bow broke. It was just a terrible commotion, and I didn't know what happened until I realized that the string had caught the GoPro and ripped it off my face. So yeah, I put it over my left eyebrow to keep that from happening. And then I had my camera arm in the backside of the tree, and I killed a hog this year, and I was actually able to get footage from both camera angles, and it was kind of cool because it showed I had to maneuver, but I thought the hog was going to come on my left side. Well, last minute, the hog's, again, the wind was really bad, swirly in Louisiana, and he caught my wind, and he was exiting, stage left, and took off. I had to get on the other side of my tether, and the GoPro actually shows me picking my bow arm up and going over the top of my tether and pivoting in my saddle to be able to shoot the hog as he's leaving. And, if I'd have just had the camera arm, you wouldn't have been able to see how I maneuvered from one side of the tether to the other. And it's just, I left that in there just to show, because I have had a lot of people asking me about how I like the saddle, or, how can you film with it? Can you shoot a trad bow out of it? And anyway, I added, left that video, that clip, that footage in there just to help maybe show somebody that it's not terrible. Like you can make it work, and it's really not hard to make it work with a trad bow. But I really enjoy filming my hunts. It's cool being able to go back and look at your your experiences over the years. It's neat.
Yeah, definitely. For me, like, there'll be even times too when I go back and I have totally forgotten about certain details, whether it's of the hunt or whether it's of deer movement or activity or weather patterns that were very relevant to the hunt that I've since forgotten. And I go back and watch the videos again, and it's like, oh yeah. Yeah, I can still apply that.
Yeah, it's really cool. I originally started doing it just because I wanted to share it with other people. You know, it's a lot easier. It's one thing to tell somebody about your hunt, but it's something else to say, hey, watch this, check this out. And that was what was cool to me, is being able to share, the experience, even if it was like a raccoon trying to climb down the tree that I'm already sitting in and us fighting for trunk space. situations like that, yeah, it's funny to talk about, but when you actually can see the coon and hear him growling at you and stuff as he's trying to get by you, stuff like that is the reason why I started filming. And then it got to be just more of an addiction than anything. Is now if I can't film, man, I get kind of frustrated if I wind up going out there. I feel naked without my camera. Now, obviously, if I get the opportunity and it's not on camera, that something's going to die, I'm not going to not shoot it because it's not on film. But, I do like to have my camera with me.
See, I'm glad I never had that. I filmed one hunt my entire life, and that was the first deer I ever killed with an Osage Orange Shelf bow.
Nice.
I think I am the only person who has ever seen that hunt on video. And I still have it somewhere in my house. I have no clue where it's at.
That's hilarious.
One hunt, I was like, this is too much work. I'm done. Sold my camera, got rid of everything. It's like, nope.
Yeah, it's a royal pain, man. What camera arm are you using?
I have a fourth aero base that I kind of customized. I put some aluminum plates. I basically swapped out all the steel on it and just used like aircraft grade aluminum to make it lighter. So I ended up taking that whole base and shoulder assembly and cutting the weight just about in half. And then I was just running that with the fourth aero, the carbon arm or the stiff arm. I had one of each, and then I ended up making one that was kind of custom also out of aluminum. And I made the top arm just a few inches shorter than the bottom arm, because when I was passing the camera arm with the saddle from one side of the bridge to the other, my shotgun mic would hit the trunk. So when I made that top arm a little bit shorter, that seemed to prevent that from happening.
Awesome. Yeah, I've had that issue with the camera arm. I saw the fourth arrow, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
I saw that last year, and I was like, man, that looks awesome, but I just can't justify dropping the money on that. so I'm using, they used to be made by Gorilla. I forget who makes them now. But it's just one of those cheapo camera arms. But my lord, it adds like 5 pounds to your pack, and just the camera arm. And it works for what it is. But yeah, it is a pain, you know, trying to get it up there, ratchet it on there, get it in the right position. Not to mention the actual headache of and stress of having a deer come in and trying to keep it on film. Trying not to spook it, trying to focus on, you know, the deer, your camera, all that kind of good stuff. It can be stressful and frustrating and all that kind of good stuff. But when it works out, man, it's worth it.
No, yeah, I always say I don't blame anybody for not wanting to film hunts, because it's you're gonna blow opportunities. You're gonna miss shots.
That's exactly why I went to one of those. As soon as I had it was like a coyote of all things. I was trying to film a coyote that came in, and I was going to shoot it. Well, he was trotting towards me, and I set the camera up and got in position. Well, at the last second, he went on the backside of the tree, and I like grabbed the camera arm, and I'm swinging it around, and he just keeps on going. And I was like, you dummy, you just let a coyote go because you're worried about a camera. And I was like, that is the last thing you need to do. And so I immediately went, I got one of those action cameras. I was like, man, if I can't get it on my regular camera, I'm still going to get it on film, whether it's a good quote-unquote quality or not. I'm still going to try to get the shot on film, even if I can't get it in my, you know, in the wheelhouse there. So I went and bought one of those, you know, point of view cameras, and now it doesn't matter what side of the tree or not that he goes on, I'm flinging an arrow.
Yeah, a couple of my shots last year were only captured on the head cam, so it definitely is valuable to have one of those, even if you are running the camera arm.
For sure. One of the bucks I killed this past year, it was funny, and I'm still a little bitter and frustrated about it. The deer, he caught me off guard, man. From the time I climbed in my tree to the time I had a dead deer was 4 minutes.
Holy smokes.
It was insane. Like, I found the scrape blind that morning. I picked the tree out. And then that evening, I rushed in. Long story short, I got in the tree. I got tethered off. I hung my backpack. And it was the day before Thanksgiving, and the day before Halloween, and I grabbed some chocolate out of my, you know, as for Halloween candy as I was leaving, and I hung my bow, and I was like, I better eat this chocolate, because it was like, you know, 88, 90 degrees, like right at 90 degrees, and I was like, this chocolate's gonna melt in my pocket if I don't eat it. So I'm literally, like, I just hung my bow in my backpack, and I grabbed this chocolate, and I started eating it, and I heard crunching, and I clipped my GoPro on, but I had not taken the time to put my camera arm up with my good camera yet. I was too worried about that chocolate, and so I'm sitting up there munching on that like a fat kid, and I heard crunching, and I look around the tree, and there's a deer, like a really good buck, walking towards him. I'm like, oh my goodness. And I reach up, and I, in my excitement, I punch my GoPro. I punch the power twice. And what that does is it turns, like the way I have it set is when you punch it twice, it automatically puts it on time lapse versus, you know, just filming. And so I have like 180 still shots of the entire process. Like, the deer walks out, he makes it, like, he goes to check the scrape, he stops and he starts making a scrape like 6 feet from the one that I was actually hunting on, and you see like these still shots of the deer walking out, I'm coming to full draw, you see me at full draw with the deer down there, and then there's like a little bit of a blurry picture right when I release. You can see a very blurry image of the arrow leaving the bow. And then I actually wound up shooting the deer. I almost completely blew the situation, but I spined the deer and dropped him in his tracks. And so the next picture is that there's a white spot through the leaves where the deer's belly is facing you. But it's all like little bitty through the leaves, whereas if it was that actual video footage, you'd actually be able to see what's going on. But with it being still shots, you can barely tell anything that's going on. I'm still mad at myself about that. So that's a lesson learned on that one.
Yeah, for me, those are the kind of lessons that I don't need to learn.
Right, you just assume, so like,
yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty fresh. I mean, it worked out. Big picture, there's a dead deer. You know, I got to experience that, but there's just not a good film to go with it.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, man, I bought a camera this spring, or winter, I guess, that has a mechanical gimbal built in, the Osmo Pocket, and I've been wearing that on a head mount. And like,
oh, really?
With a compound, it hasn't, like, the footage is always pretty decent, but it seemed like with a compound, when I just have like a Sony or GoPro or whatever on the head mount. But it seemed like whenever I was shooting a traditional bow, like, just because there's more, I guess, more recoil generally for me after the shot.
Right.
It seems like shooting a trad bow with a head cam, it's not quite as, like, it's not shaky, but it's also not as crisp as it could be. But I'm shooting with that Osmo camera in my head. It's like it's sitting on a tripod. Like, it's just crisp. And you can play it back in slow motion and just, like, watch that arrow go. It's pretty impressive.
Way.
Yeah.
I've never even, what's it called?
Osmo Pocket.
Osmo Pocket?
Yeah, I'll send you some test footage after this, so you can take a look.
Yeah, I'm curious about that. Is it sold, like, all in one piece, or you're buying just the headgear and then the whatever camera you have goes with it, or is it, like, camera and everything included?
It's like a... It's basically like a drone camera on a small stick, and it's got like a little, it's got like a little 3/4 inch or 1 inch screen right on it with like two main buttons to do the controls. So there's like a power button, there's a record button, and then the rest of it's via touchscreen. So I had to build like a mount for it so I could put it on a head strap, and it's not waterproof and it's not as robust and it takes a little bit longer to turn on. So it's not like it's the best in all categories, but for actually getting the shot filmed and make it look really nice, like, I'll be pretty impressed.
That is cool. Do you think is there any way you think you could, like, is it all wired in together? Is there any way you could take the gimbal part of it and attach a GoPro or something, or another camera to it?
With that one, you can't, but there's other small miniaturized gimbals that are made for, like, GoPros. Like, there's ones that are made for chest mounts for, like, mountain bikers. I think Evo SS, and there's another one called Feutech that makes small little gimbals for that. But, I mean, they're more weight than you'd want to put on your head, probably. They're a little bit on the heavier side. But this one's pretty light. It's maybe
very
like,
cool.
I would say it's less than 10 ounces.
I honestly never thought about that.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, because that's always one of those. It's a little frustrating. Like you said, it doesn't matter. The GoPro is obviously better than the... I say obviously, it's better than my, I have an old Sony action camera, and then I have a GoPro, I think it's a Hero 5, obviously there's, what's it called, the I want to say shock absorption, but that's not it, stabilization,
yeah.
It has the stabilization on there, with the GoPro that the Sony doesn't, so the Sony footage on the shot is really blurry. And GoPro footage is a lot more smooth, but you still get a little vibration, a little bit of blur when you try to back it up.
Yeah, the Sony X3000 has really good image stabilization, which I think might be a model newer than what you had. But then the GoPro 7, like the most recent one that they've made, that one has really good electronic stabilization too.
Huh, interesting.
But it's not as good in low light, interestingly.
Really?
Yeah.
See, that was why I originally went with the Sony action camera, at the time, I forget which GoPro Hero was out, but they were, one at the time, they were having a lot of bugs, like there were quite a few little glitches, and one of them was the fact that you couldn't make it sound, you couldn't turn the sound off of it. Like there was always a beep.
Oh, yeah.
When I bought it. And then when you looked at the footage side by side, the Sony Action camera was way better in low light, like in trees. It was much better in low light than the GoPro, where the problem with it is in daylight, like in a field scenario, the Sony overexposed really bad because of the presettings in there. And now the GoPro I have now, it works pretty good because, you know, you can control the settings from the app on your phone. So in low light, I'll start playing with the ISO and, you know, the aperture, all that kind of stuff on the GoPro, and I can brighten it up as it starts getting lower light, and I can get more light out of filming with the GoPro now than what I could with the action camera that I had. But like I said, I had one of the older action cameras when they first came out.
Yeah, they definitely made improvements across the board. Although I will say for low light, it's like an action camera, no matter how good it is, still is not great in low lights, like no matter what. But there's a camera called the Psionics, which actually it's kind of billed as like a night vision camera. But it's not too much heavier than, I'm trying to think of what it'd be like maybe most similar to. It's probably twice the weight of a GoPro, I'd say, but it's still small enough that you could wear it on like a head strap, and it films in 720. So the resolution isn't like fantastic. Not like 4K resolution or anything like that, but the low light is otherworldly. It's like you can see much better through the camera than you can just with your naked eye.
Wow, that's cool.
It's crazy. It's mind blowing. Look at some of those test footage that he sent me on that. It's just like, okay.
I've shot some targets with a lighted knock, like dark enough where I have to like really strain to make sure I'm not going to miss the target. And I play that footage back, and you shoot it, and the lighted knock hits the target, and the lighted knock like glows the ground around it because it's almost like acting like a flashlight, and the camera's just able to pick up all that extra light.
Wow, that is insane. That's one of the biggest frustrations is low light with the camera, and you know, because in most scenarios, once the camera's done, but you can still hunt for, you know, depending on where you're at, sometimes 20 minutes.
Oh yeah.
You know, even though the camera's out and that like prime time, especially like when I went bear hunting a couple of years ago, it stays late. Like the twilight hour in Idaho is crazy. Like in northern Idaho is like crazy long compared to down here. So like I'd lose camera light really early, and I'm like, man, this is like I still have 30-40 minutes for bears to move, and I can't even film. And so that's kind of frustrating in those scenarios, but I am glad that the technology is coming along. Not that they're designing technology for people who want to film their hunts, but it would be nice.
Oh yeah, I can think of a lot of features and, you know, good things from various individual cameras. If you could somehow figure out a way to combine it all into one package, you'd actually have something pretty good.
Yeah, and the problem is there's no middle ground. It's either, you know, a cheap version that has almost everything, or over the top professional one that's got more than you could ever want. You know, $20,000 and 30 pounds type scenario.
Right.
So, Bobby, what camera do you use?
I don't use one anymore. That went away a long time ago.
I'm popping off.
I think it was Man, I
just didn't want you to feel left out of this conversation.
Yeah, it was from Campbell Cameras. I don't know if they're still around, but it was, man, I don't even remember what it was now. But it took the little mini VHS tape at the time.
Oh, that's how long ago that is. Was. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's awesome. I've got a we used to have one of those cameras. Me and my brother, we'd film each other. We've got several old deer hunts, and like my first turkey hunt, his first turkey hunt, is filmed on those little and now there's absolutely nothing that we can play any of that footage on.
Yeah, I know.
So I couldn't tell you where that footage is anyway. I'm sure it's tucked away somewhere in my parents' attic.
You guys are crazy. I'll just leave it at that.
It's fun though. So, do Bobby? Do you work for Arrow Hunter? Like, or do you help manufacture the saddles? Like, what's your story on that?
No, so I'm basically just a product design consultant.
Gotcha. Okay, that's what I was thinking. I couldn't remember.
Yeah. So I don't actually work for the company. I just help them design it. That's kind of the way everything fell together is, you know, they just reached out and was like, hey, you want to help us design this? And so spent some years working with them and their sewers to get it sewed up. And you can see the progression through the different models was, obviously, they're a tree climbing company, so they wanted all the tree climbing stuff built into it, and they were not hunters, so they couldn't understand how we used it so much differently than they did.
Right.
And so that's what took so long for the evolution of it to go through from the original Arrow Hunter to the Evolution to the Kestrel to the Kite.
Very nice. Yeah, I was curious about that when I was interested in them a long time ago, but I kept putting it off, and something, I forget what it was, I saw something and it sparked the interest again, and I just started doing a bunch of digging, and that's when I found the Arrow Hunter, the Kestrel. And when I found it, it had just come out. It was one of those deals, I think, where you pre-order maybe. And I ordered one of those right after they first come out, I think. I might have thought that they had first come out, but it's probably I just found them. But that was the one I originally got, and I almost went and got the Kite, and I'm like, you know what, I can't justify that. Like, that's a substantial weight difference, but at the same time, I'm like, you know, this Kestrel's working great for me. It's comfortable. I really don't have any complaints with it at all.
Yeah, that's good. That's the thing, is the Kite's just a slimmed down version of the Kestrel. Basically, it's the same design, same function, just a lighter weight mesh. A lot of people wanted it. You know, to me, I think I've hunted out of a Kite like 10 times. Outside of that, I still have the first actual Kestrel that I hunt from that was, I don't know how many years old it is now. It's what it was all built off of, and for me, it works great, so.
Yeah, that sounds like me. If it's not broke, don't fix it, guy.
Yeah.
Just buy two of them.
There was a guy that, I forget who he was, but he used both, or he had the Kestrel, he ordered the Kite, and after he got the Kite, he was like, man, the Kestrel was just more comfortable to me. Like, he thought the mesh was going to be more comfortable, and for whatever reason, he wound up liking the full fabric feel better, and wound up selling his Kite. So yeah, I thought that was interesting.
If I remember right, they sell Kestrels to Kites. It's like 4-to-1 or 5-to-1 Kestrels over Kites.
Really?
So, yeah.
Wow. I would think the opposite.
Yeah, you would think the opposite, but the Kestrel is by far the number one seller. Has always and is always. When we first released it, I think they put it on the website and it wasn't even completely done. And I think they had something like 150 orders in the first 2.5 hours. Like, people were typing in the comments what they wanted, like, color-wise and all that, because they didn't even have it on the website yet.
Wow, that's awesome. Good grief. Jared, is that what you use? Are you using the Kestrel?
I got, like, one everything. So I like to try to hunt out of, like, pretty much every saddle option at least a little bit throughout the season, just because, like, it's honestly, like, during the hunting season, it's, like, 2 or 3 times a week, sometimes more, that I'll get questions about, you know, X, Y, or Z saddle. So I like to have at least a little bit of background about, you know, kind of all of them.
Right. Yeah, I get asked this, a lot of the same stuff, and I'm like, well, I can tell you opinions based on what I've read on these two, but only one I can really tell you about is the Kestrel. And I do have a tethered platform, the Mantis, I think. No,
Predator.
Is it the Predator? Yeah, Predator. I have that platform. At the time, I don't know if Arrow Hunter even makes a platform now, whether they do or not. They didn't, or I didn't see it when I got the saddle originally. But again, that was one of those things when I realized I wanted a platform, that they were the ones that had it. So
yeah, I mean, that's still pretty much the one I run exclusively, is that Predator.
Do what now?
I said that Predator platform is pretty much the option that I run exclusively, no matter what saddle I'm using.
Yeah, the thing is awesome. It's super lightweight. I like how compact it is. Good stuff.
Cool, man. Well, I think this is a pretty good conversation. There's a lot of good info in this.
I enjoyed it. Yeah, definitely. So before we jump off here, tell people where they can find you and kind of where they can look at your just beyond amazing taxidermy work as well. I don't know about all that, but thank
you. Oh, come on now.
I've got a Instagram page for my bow hunting endeavors. It's Bayou Bow Hunter. Along with that, I have a YouTube channel, Bayou Bow Hunter, and Facebook page, Bayou Bow Hunter. Facebook and Instagram page are kind of tied together, but I do put more on Instagram. It's just easier to load a quick picture and run with it. Videos, obviously, on Bayou Bow Hunter. My taxidermy is New Life Taxidermy is the name of my business. My Instagram name for the taxidermy is New Life Taxidermy. Imagine that. And my Facebook page is Carson's New Life Taxidermy, because there was actually another New Life Taxidermy, and I think it was in North Carolina or Wisconsin. It was somewhere in the Northeast. So I had to use Carson's New Life Taxidermy on Facebook. But yeah, that's my info, and I get asked info probably as much. You know, I'm sure y'all get asked a lot more than what I do. Y'all are out there a good bit more, but you know, I try to respond as much as I can. I get asked bow tuning questions, archery, taxidermy, like all kinds of questions, and I don't mind responding. So if anybody has any questions, feel free to message me on any of that. I enjoy trying to help people, because I didn't have the help when I was learning, especially with a traditional bow. And if I could help shorten somebody else's learning curve, I'd love to be able to help somebody figure it out and enjoy the frustrations with me. But I appreciate y'all having me on. I've had a good time. It's been a good conversation. Yeah, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
As always, make sure to follow and like the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network on iTunes, Facebook, Instagram, wherever you typically download to listen to your podcast. Leave us a review. Continue to send in questions, and thanks for listening.